I'd like now to welcome Emily Kaltenbach. She is State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance and Detective Sergeant Jerome Sanchez with the Santa Fe Police Department. They are co-chairs of the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Task Force, which is called LEAD, L-E-A-D. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. Let's talk for a second about LEAD. What is it? What is that all about? Who is diverting who from what?
So the idea is to divert someone who has been caught with a small amount of either pills or heroin directly into social supports and treatment. So what happens now is that someone is caught with a small amount of drugs and they're immediately booked into jail. But sometimes they don't get the treatment and the social supports they need in their time while they're incarcerated, and the cycle just continues. So they're back on the street, often picked up once again for the same crime. And so there's just this revolving door. The idea behind LEAD is that it's a pre-booking diversion, that people get the social supports and services they need to break that cycle of addiction and arrest.
And we're talking about opiates, opiate pills, and heroin.
Correct.
Are the patterns of addiction similar with those two drugs, opiate pills and heroin?
Usually the way it starts in Santa Fe that I've noticed is it basically starts with pills, is what we're seeing. And then they can't afford pills anymore, so they start using heroin because it's much cheaper. So that's basically what we've seen.
And who are the people who are using these kinds of drugs? I mean, what demographics are we talking about?
What we're seeing are younger adults, probably between the ages of maybe 18 and 27-ish.
And they are people who are doing what? They're out of work?
Most of them are out of work, probably because they've racked up some charges and have a history now and are considered felons. But you do have some that tend to are able to function normally, if you want to say it, in society, but are still addicted, but maybe are not committing crimes, but that are just able to maintain, you know, their addiction. But for the most part, as far as criminals go, that's about the age group is 18. Maybe early 30s.
Now, all this is related to the burglary situation here in Santa Fe.
Correct.
Yep. And what we found is that oftentimes to support an addiction, these individuals are involved in low-level property crimes. Actually, maybe not even low-level. I mean, I think across the board, and I think the sergeant can speak to that better than I can. But so the idea of this model is not only about breaking the cycle of addiction, sort of a public health approach, it's also a public safety approach. And so if we can break that addiction, then we can break that cycle of property crime, which we all know plagues our city,
right,
and is a real concern to our city leaders. So I want to commend our city leaders for looking at a model that's really innovative, that is really mostly about public safety. It's making our families safer, but and our streets safer, but it's also making our families healthier because they're going to get the treatment and social supports that they need.
What's the model for this program?
The model came out of Seattle. That piloted, started this in a couple of years ago. So it's very innovative. It's very new. They're the only jurisdiction in this country that's trying pre-booking diversion or LEAD. And so Santa Fe would become the second in the nation to actually try to replicate this. We're very focused on opiates because we know that opiate addiction tends to lead directly to the property crime issue. In Seattle, they're a little broader. So if this program's successful, I hope we'd consider it for other types of drugs that people need treatment and social supports for.
If you're a heroin addict, what does it cost per day to feed your addiction?
It depends on how advanced they are. So you could have what they refer to as partiers, people who maybe use it occasionally on the weekends. And then you have your full-blown addicts who are what they call strung out. So those guys could be probably a gram a day. So we're talking at least $80 to $100 a day.
And so that leads to, because nobody makes that or nobody has that kind of extra income, probably who's a heroin addict. So that leads to burglaries and fencing operations and probably shoplifting.
Right.
What is the role of gangs in this whole story?
I'm not the expert on gangs. I personally don't see a lot, or that the people that I deal with or interact with don't mention that they belong to a gang. So I personally don't see a lot of gang presence.
Are these folks interacting with each other? In other words, do you have a group of two or three people doing burglaries, that kind of thing?
You could have, it's strange, but it's almost its own little community. So they do talk to each other, mainly probably in jail when they're in there. But they all kind of are aware of each other, and they do talk about each other. And so, yeah, it's almost its own little community where they communicate with each other.
So the idea of this LEAD program, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, would be that a police person like you would pick somebody up for a property crime, find that they had heroin or opiates on them, and then instead of booking them into the law enforcement system, they would book them into, what would it be, a clinic?
They would be taken directly to a case manager, so someone who's able, right at that moment. So it's sort of a idea of a 24/7 type model where they interact with someone who does an intake and an assessment, and an individualized care plan is developed. Now, that person, we talk to a lot of people who don't have housing supports or, as the sergeant said, are unemployed. And so we know if we can't address some of those needs, then that person's never going to be successful in breaking their addiction. And so the model that we've developed is that there's an intensive case management component to help people get into the services they need. So that person then meets with a case manager, a plan is developed. They might need inpatient residential treatment for 30 days. They might need outpatient Suboxone treatment with group therapy. Everyone's going to be different because of their specific needs, but a plan is developed and they're immediately referred into those service systems.
During this time, are they essentially locked up? I mean, do they go home? What happens?
They go home and they meet with the case manager, and then the case manager basically at that point they discuss the individual case plan and how they're going to take care of or try to help with the addiction. Everybody's different, everybody's individual, so what could work for one may not work for the other. So that's where the case manager and those wraparound services start. In dealing and meeting with these people and interacting with them, that's been one of the common problems that they express is that as soon as they're out of jail, there really isn't anything for them to fall back on. So they really need that support that surrounds them on a constant basis to be successful. And many of them have said that. And that's kind of what we focused the plan to be, is that the case manager is constantly involved in their lives and so that they know that somebody's holding them accountable, and make sure that they go to meetings or to hold up their end of the bargain. So that's ultimately what ends up happening with them.
And I would just add that there's some strict eligibility criteria, so that if someone is a violent offender or has a violent past, they're not eligible for this. And so the task force has really spent a lot of time determining who can be eligible for diversion. You know, only up to a certain amount of drugs, of opiates, is allowed. You know, so if someone's actually trafficking and selling, they're not eligible for diversion. So we're really trying to target a group that we know will be successful, but also their addiction isn't harming necessarily the public, so that, you know, that it's, again, a balance between the public health and the public safety approach that's really important. And the prosecutors, so the district attorneys, have veto power. So if they, they meet, there's an operational group that meets with law enforcement and prosecutors, and they really staff the cases to make sure that no one is being diverted that shouldn't be diverted. So there is a check and balance of the model.
Very interesting. We're talking to Emily Kaltenbach and Detective Sergeant Jerome Sanchez about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Task Force, which they are co-chairs of. It must be quite an emotionally difficult and painful thing for policemen, although maybe you train yourself not to go there too much, but to see these young people with lots of potential and presumably intelligence and all of that cycling through this system over and over, cycling through addiction, cycling through jail, and having their chances be ever less each time for success.
Right, and that's ultimately the promising thing about LEAD is, you know, some police officers put on the air that maybe they don't care, or they may even say that, but I think truly deep down, all of our officers care about what happens in our community. And I've been an officer for 17 years, so I'm not ashamed to say that I do care about what happens to some of these people, because you do. You do meet them, you do meet their families, you do meet their kids, and you do meet their parents, and you develop those relationships in dealing with these people constantly. You know, I've dealt now with generations because I've been around for 17 years, and I see them grow up. And so, yes, I mean, you develop those relationships with people, and you want to see them succeed and to grow up and be fine citizens. But sometimes that doesn't happen. So it can hurt emotionally.
There's the problem that has been talked about a great deal in northern New Mexico of generations of addicts, and that must be a particularly tough cycle to break.
I would imagine it's huge, and we do see that. And now, again, being here for 17 years, I definitely have seen multi-generations of heroin addict or heroin addicted families here in New Mexico. And I'm born and raised, so I know a lot of these families and have maybe grown up with their kids and have known their parents to use and their grandparents to use. So it is tough.
Do you see, having been doing this for so long, a relationship between drug selling and drug use and the poor economy?
I personally don't see that. What I do see is an issue with maybe education, and maybe people not learning a trade. So they get involved in crime so early in their lives, and they start developing records. And so naturally businesses don't want to hire them because they may be around money or around property, and so maybe they don't trust them. But without an education and without learning a trade, they really don't have anything to fall back on other than what they know. And that's, you know, committing crimes to feed their addiction.
How does the heroin problem here in Santa Fe compare to the rest of the country?
Well, New Mexico, I'll start with New Mexico, because New Mexico leads the nation in overdose deaths, accidental overdose deaths. And that's a rate for the state. And so we're really faced with an epidemic in our state. And you'll see there are pockets within our state that are even worse. You mentioned Rio Riba County. Their overdose death rate is 5 times the national average. In New Mexico, it's about twice, maybe a little over. And here in Santa Fe, we're about third or fourth in the state for the number of overdoses. So our rate is a little lower than some other counties, but because of our population, we have quite a few number of overdose deaths, and that's really concerning. And what we find is that often these individuals who are struggling with an addiction to an opiate, when they're put into jail, they go through a detox process, and their bodies are then that much more vulnerable to the drug if they use once they're released. And so we're seeing a lot of deaths by individuals who come directly out of the jail or the correctional system suffering from overdoses. And so that's really concerning. So again, that's one of the benefits of LEAD, is that if we can get them into treatment right away, we might try to address some of the concern about overdose deaths.
And I would imagine there's so many components to treatment. I mean, there's the physiological piece that you were talking about and getting them on other kinds of, what would you call them, treatment drugs?
Yeah, it's called medication-assisted treatment. So we mostly know about methadone, which is the most common medication-assisted treatment. And with methadone, you go to a clinic every day, you get your medicine. There is a fairly new medication that's called Suboxone or buprenorphine, which is in an outpatient setting. And that's great, especially for New Mexico. That's a rural area where we don't have access to methadone clinics. And it just depends on what's right for that individual. So we're hoping people in this program will have a choice to either, you know, get buprenorphine in an outpatient setting or have access to methadone. But in addition, you have to have some of the therapies that go along, outpatient therapies, and the wraparound services, legal services, housing, food, transportation.
And also, there's this other factor that can't be so well controlled by a program, which is getting folks into a different group of friends and a different culture where they're not going to just go back to their old patterns and habits.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real issue. For some people, they do need to separate from their community. What we've also heard, we met with a couple of young men at the detention center here in Santa Fe to sort of get their perspective on the program. And what was striking to me was that they said that family supports was the most important for them in order to break their addiction. So for some people, it's getting away from their family. For others, it's bringing the family supports back into their lives. And
that's if that family is supportive.
That's right, if they have that support.
Then there is also job training and getting people on a new path. Is that part of this as well?
Yes, that's the idea, is that that's one of the wraparound services.
What kind of jobs are you looking at training people for? I mean, is there a whole set of trades that people will be able to get trained into?
At this point, that's still in the planning process. But we hope that there are opportunities. We know that we're, as a country, suffering from job losses. New Mexico probably at the top of that list. But one of the ideas a community member suggested, a mentorship program. And it would be great to see local businesses who are willing to say, well, mentor this person. I'll give them a chance to work with us. And sort of a big brother's big sister model, so to speak. So, you know, that's also under consideration.
How many people would you say we're talking about, like, would really be eligible for this program in a given year?
I think the research was that we found probably 100. There were 100 people in Santa Fe within the city limits that could possibly be eligible for the program.
And so those 100 people, those guys, is it mostly guys? Is it,
or it's varied.
Men and women both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are these young adults struggling with this addiction? Do we have data? Do we have data yet from Seattle or from other programs how well these kind of treatment programs actually work?
So we have decades of data on whether the treatment programs work. So methadone has been around for over 40 years. We know that these treatment modalities are evidence-based. But we also know that sometimes that relapse is part of that treatment process, and so we don't expect that someone will go into 30 days and they're going to be completely on their way to fighting their addiction. But what we also know is that we did a cost-benefit analysis here in Santa Fe, the 100 number that the sergeant mentioned, and we looked specifically at Santa Fe Police Department data and the County Detention Center data, and we cross-referenced that with cost data, and it was astounding to see that 100 people, when they were processed through the jail system, the prosecutor system, the medical system, cost $4.2 million over 3 years.
Oh, my
goodness.
Just
100 people.
100 people.
It cost the city in just jail and law enforcement for that three-year period $1 million. So if we can imagine using those dollars for services, and really shifting, cost shifting those dollars, we're going to be benefiting our community. And it's also a fiscal issue. So we did this great, Santa Fe Community Foundation did a great study that I think is very telling and opens the eyes of our lawmakers that say, you know, we're not only is this public health, public safety, but it's a fiscal issue. What, you know, it would be great if Sergeant Sanchez and his group could be back on the streets really dealing with violent crime and not spending, I think it's over 9 hours per person trying to, you know, book them and transfer them to the jail. They could be dealing with the issues that our community really cares about.
We're talking to Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance and Detective Sergeant Jerome Sanchez of the Santa Fe Police Department. And it's also a moral issue. These people's lives should be spent in a more fruitful way than what they're being spent now, in addition to a fiscal issue and everything else.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that here are individuals that we know, even if they had made it, were caught early on in their lives. They're, let's say, an 18-year-old. They're caught with a small amount of heroin. That going to jail sometimes is not the best place for them to really break that cycle. You know, that's sort of our perspective at Drug Policy Alliance, that that cycle can be so devastating to them and their families. Now they have a felony on their record. What job are they going to be able to get? This is a moral and an economic issue. And so,
and the experience of going to jail doesn't exactly help somebody's state of mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think they meet some of their colleagues in jail.
They tend to get used to it. So it becomes familiar and it becomes... And if we're talking about generations that do this, you know, mom and dad used to do it, so it's comfortable for them. But, I mean, yeah, we could have some more productive people. And that's been one of the biggest arguments also, is that some of these people come to us and say, we just can't get a job. And people tell us to occupy our time somehow. And we would love to occupy our time by getting a job and being more meaningful. And I think that would really help, is if we could get some people trained in a trade and maybe get them a job.
It's rough. I mean, there are people who've been excellent tradesmen for 25 and 30 years who, in this economy, are working minimum wage jobs.
Right.
It's a rough moment. So this program that you're talking about, and that you are the co-chairs of, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Project, you guys are co-chairs of the task force. What stage is it in? It's the planning has happened, now you're about to implement?
We're hoping January 1 we can get going, and we're still trying to tie up some loose ends here and trying to figure out some other things that we need to do, but we're hoping by January 1 we can do full implementation.
When you talk to the young adults who might be in this program, what do they say?
They're excited. You know, for the most part, addicts are good people that are just addicted to heroin. Will do anything that they can to get the drug. But for the most part, a lot of them are so excited to get going. And so is me and my unit. My unit is on board with this, which involves about four or five other detectives that deal with the same people over and over and over again. And we just are kind of hitting our heads up against the wall saying, we just need to get this lead project going. They ask me just about every week, how far are we in lead and how close are we to get this thing going? Because we just can't keep chasing the same people over and over again. So.
And so once you get this going, you'll do it for a year or two and then really evaluate how it's working.
Mm-hmm. We hope to be a 3-year pilot project and do a formal evaluation to really determine whether it's working. I mean, we have to try something new, right? This may not end up being the answer, but we can't continue to address the issue the way we've been doing it. It's just not working anymore. And even our mayor says we can't, and our chief say we can't arrest our way out of this issue.
Yeah.
And we need to treat it like a health issue.
What's happening in Seattle? I mean, you're getting good data back from them?
Yeah, they're going to start their formal evaluation process very soon. They also did a 3-year pilot project. And what we're hearing is that they're really reducing recidivism. So this, as the sergeant mentioned, they're picking up the same people over and over again. In Seattle, they've seen a decline in return arrests of individuals that are reoffending. And what they also, you know, it's going to be different in Seattle than here, but what they're finding is that a lot of their individuals are homeless, and so they're spending a lot of time providing housing supports that then lead to a much healthier outcome for that individual. Once they have shelter, they're really able to deal with their addiction.
Emily Kaltenbach is State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Detective Sergeant Jerome Sanchez is with the Santa Fe Police Department. They're co-chairs of the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Task Force, also known as LEAD. And we look forward to having you back on the air to let us know how it's going. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.